Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
My name is Melanie Perkins McLaughlin, and I'm a documentary filmmaker. And when I was 9 years old, my childhood friend vanished from a public swimming pool in Lawrence, Massachusetts on August 21st, 1976. His name was Andy Puglisi, and he was 10 years old.
Hello, and welcome to episode 29 of The Vanished. I would like to thank everyone for listening, and those of you who have generously contributed on Patreon to help defray some of the production costs of the show. Tonight I'll be discussing the 1976 disappearance of 10-year-old Andy Puglisi. As you heard, I had the pleasure of speaking with Melanie for this episode. Melanie created a documentary about Andy called Have You Seen Andy? In 2008, she won an Emmy for Outstanding Investigative Journalism for her work on the film. I asked her to explain why she decided to make the film.
When Andy disappeared, I was one of hundreds of children in the housing project where we lived. And the search only lasted for like 6 days. And suddenly it was called off and we didn't know why. And I remember thinking that when I grew up, I would try to find out what happened to him. And, you know, as naive as that sounds, it's really how it started. And then I did go to school for documentary filmmaking, and after about 10 or 15 years of working on other people's films, I felt it was time to make my own film. And having watched how hard people worked on creating films, I knew that if I was going to create my own, it would have to be something I would want to do, whether it got picked up by a broadcaster or not, just something that I had a passion for that I had always wanted to do. And really, there were probably two things in my life that I felt that way about at that time. And one was what happened to Andy. So I started off very naively, just picking up the phone and starting to make phone calls. But I did have a strong background in research for documentary films because I had worked on them for 15 years or more. So I knew how to start that process.
Since I have absolutely no experience with filmmaking, I wondered what the process of creating the documentary was like.
So off and on, it took, I guess I started in 99 and it broadcast in 07, but I did take a few years. I had two children while I was making the film, so I did take some time off, especially given the nature of the film and the subject matter. I took some time off during that. So I would say if you really put it all together, it would probably be maybe 4 or 5 years.
Melanie had a crush on Andy, and she shared some of her memories about him with me.
Andy was a really good-looking little boy. He was had this hair that sort of covered one of his eyes and a big smile. And he had just moved into the projects that March. And I had met him through my brother, who is just a year older than me. And they were playing a game outside, football or something. And I wanted to join in. And my brother instinctively said no. And Andy said that if I couldn't play, he wasn't going to play either. And so that sort of initiated this crush I had on him. And he was a kind kid. You know, he was the oldest of all of his siblings and he was nurturing by nature. He just was inclusive and, you know, always thought about other people. And another vivid memory I have of him is going to his house at one point and he was watching his brothers and sisters and he was handing out cookies to them. And it came to my turn and he gave me two. And I thought that was really sweet. And it was sort of, I guess, him flirting with me at that point. And, you know, I just liked him. He was a really nice kid. And he was the kind of kid that would help anyone.
Having a loved one go missing has a profound effect, not only on the family, but also on friends and the whole community.
Well, you know, I don't think you realize perhaps until you become an adult. And by adult, I mean a real grown up, you know, when you're really able to absorb your life a little bit and reflect on things that have happened in the past, you realize how much things have truly impacted you. And like all of the other children in the projects and all of the adults in the projects, it was a trauma. It was a trauma that we all survived and it lives with us every day. And, you know, we work through it in different ways individually, but I think it's impacted my life significantly. I mean, so much so obviously that I spent several years making this film and fundraising to tell Andy's story, but also feeling the privilege of telling his story for all of the other children that needed the story told. And, you know, I get together with any of those children, now adults today, and they all talk about how significant his disappearance has been in their life and continues to be, and how much it is affecting their roles as parents and as partners. I mean, it's just affected us in every way. And his family, especially, of course, has been affected in every way, much more so than, you know, the people in the community of children that were in the projects. But again, his family first and foremost, and then this sort of extended circle, and then wider circle out into the community as a whole. And I still have people from around the world that email me that see the documentary and are deeply affected and troubled by it, his disappearance. So I think it continues to resonate for a lot of people around the world.
When I research a case, I usually check out the area on Google Maps. But with an older case, the area is often very different today than it was 40 years ago. Melanie described what the area was like on August 21st, 1976.
So the area that Andy disappeared was a state swimming pool, and it was across the street from the housing projects where we lived. And the housing projects, like I said, had a couple of hundred children. And this pool was like our vacation. It was, you know, opened every year. It was open all summer long, and it was where we went and spent, you know, hours and hours every day. So there was the projects on one side and then the pool. And then on the other side of the pool was a wooded area and a city dump. And then parallel to the city dump was a highway. And so it was easy access on and off the highway to get to the swimming pool. And also on the other side of the projects was a elementary school and a middle school. So it was a community that had a lot of children teeming in it at all times, all summer long, and then easy access on and off the highway. And then in a secluded area, wooded area, right all around it, around the perimeter of the pool. So, you know, it was sort of an ideal spot if you were considering abducting a child, I guess.
On the day that Andy disappeared, he and Melanie had spent time together at the pool.
I remember it was really hot. It was one of the hottest days of the summer, and we woke up hot, you know, and we were just waiting for the pool to open. I think it was, you know, 10 o'clock the pool opened, and we couldn't wait. And we went over there as soon as we could. And it was so hot that, you know, you jump into the water to cool off and you wouldn't even be out for 5 minutes and you'd need to jump in again. And I remember, you know, Andy being there and all of us playing like we normally did. And then I think we were taking a break for a little bit, because sometimes they had sort of mandatory breaks where the lifeguards would make you get out of the pool so everyone could take a rest. And we were sitting under this little tiny overhang outside of the bathroom area, because it was really probably one of the only places that had shade when you were waiting to be able to get back in the pool. So we were all sort of crammed in there, Andy and my brother and another friend from the projects and myself. And I was really starting to get hungry, and I'm sure it was past lunch, and I hadn't eaten for several hours, and I wanted to go home. And I asked Andy if he would walk me home. And he said he didn't want to, that he wanted to continue swimming. And I was a little bit irritated, because, you know, usually if you asked Andy to do something, he would do it. And I sort of considered him, I guess, my crush or my boyfriend at that point. And so when he said he wouldn't, I asked my brother if he would walk me home. And this is always interesting to me, because there were plenty of other times that I left the pool and I would go home by myself. So why I wouldn't go home by myself that day has always been curious to me. But I asked my brother to walk me home, and he also said no, that he wanted to stay longer. So I sort of left in a bit of a huff, and I think I told my brother I would tell my mother that he said he wouldn't walk me home. And I left the swimming pool, and I started to walk out the front gate. And my brother says that he turned to Andy and another friend and said, you know, I better catch up with her, or I'm going to get in trouble. And so he caught up with me, and we walked home, and we must have gone home for lunch. And I think it was probably 2 o'clock or something. It was way past lunchtime, and must have gone home and eaten. And then, you know, for whatever reason, probably tired, didn't go back to the pool. And then later on in the middle of the night, you know, after we had gone to bed, there was someone pounding on our door. I remember waking up because somebody was banging on the door, and then hearing my mother's voice call me and my brother downstairs and have us sit at the kitchen table. And there was a police officer sitting at our table, and he was asking us when was the last time we had seen Andy. and what to remember about the day. And, you know, I sort of thought he was going to be in trouble. I mean, actually before that, earlier in the night, they were saying Andy hadn't come home and you could hear adults sort of calling for him. But I just figured he was at the stadium or something and he had, you know, stayed out longer than he was supposed to and he was going to get in trouble. But, you know, then we had dinner time and went to bed and didn't hear anything more of it until the policeman knocked on the door and asked us if we had seen Andy.
When someone goes missing, we tend to sympathize with the situation from our own point of view. When I look into a case about a missing child, I tend to look at it from the point of view of a mother. But this case made me stop and think about what it would be like as a child to have a friend go missing.
After the policeman knocked on our door in the middle of the night, I'm not exactly sure of what the time was, but I remember the next day, suddenly there were all kinds of people in the projects. There were National Guards literally like marching through the projects, calling Andy's name, and there were helicopters overhead. And, you know, shortly after that, right across the street on the in the stadium, they had set up a CB trucker, you know, with all these, what do you call it, 18-wheeler trucks and CB station. And that was, I guess, headquarters for the search for Andy. And, you know, people were calling his name and it was just, it was chaos and it was very frightening for a child. And you could see it escalating and I could see fear on the adults' faces. And, you know, these are adults who are pretty weathered adults, you know, survivors themselves. To see them afraid as a child, made me more afraid. And, I remember the children were involved in the searches for him. You know, they took my brothers and drove them in police cars and, elsewhere into wards looking for him. And, you know, I guess that's about as much as I remember, but I remember it being sort of very chaotic and then suddenly very abruptly.
We had a little issue with our audio there at the end of that clip, but what she said was that the search was chaotic and then ended abruptly. In the documentary, Melanie discussed a Polaroid photo that Andy had brought home shortly before he disappeared.
Yeah, so one of the things about making a documentary or telling a story over time is that things evolve, right? So you find things out over time, and that's one of the benefits of a longitudinal documentary because you start to slowly put puzzle pieces together and you start to really add things up over time. And so one of the things that came out over time was that Andy, shortly before he disappeared, came to his mother with Polaroid pictures. And she asked them where he had gotten these Polaroid pictures of himself. And Andy told his mom that a man had taken these pictures of him and given him some. And his mom was indignant about somebody taking his picture and said, "Don't let anybody take your picture." And, you know, took the Polaroids from Andy. And that was sort of the end of it as far as she had known. But fast forward, you know, however many years, 20 something years, when I start making the documentary and look into one of the main suspects in Andy's disappearance, look into him further and explain that there were several Polaroids in his possession when he got arrested and that he had all kinds of photographic equipment and film equipment to make photos and to make films. And then you could see the importance of that Polaroid and potentially of who could have been taking those Polaroids of Andy. So my position is that perhaps Wayne Chapman or someone that Wayne Chapman may have been working with was taking pictures of children to identify which children, if any, they were going to abduct to use either in human trafficking or in some of the pornography that I believe that they were producing.
Melanie and I discussed a couple of the suspects in Andy's case. The first suspect is Charles Pierce, who has been linked to crimes against children dating back to the 1950s. Just like last episode with the Lyon sisters, Charles Pierce also was a carnival worker who traveled extensively. In 1978, he was convicted of raping a child in Florida. In 1979, he confessed to killing 13-year-old Michelle Wilson. In 1981, he confessed to killing between 15 and 20 other children.
So I'll tell you, Charles Pierce was never even on my radar when I was making the film. It wasn't until I had gotten some files from Andy's police file that I noticed an email about an inmate who had talked to a prison guard and said that he had abducted a child from Lawrence, Massachusetts. And I was asking if Lawrence police had followed up on this particular email, and it didn't seem as though they had. And I had no idea who Charles Pierce was at that point, just his name in this letter with his date of birth. But the Boston Globe was following me at that point because they had become aware of the story through a newspaper article from the Lawrence Eagle Tribune, and because I had reached out to them. So the Boston Globe had a reporter following me as I was making the beginning of the film. And so she had many more resources at her fingertips. Judith Gaines was the reporter, and she had many more resources at her fingertips than I did. So I could give her this information, Charles Pierce, with a date of birth, and she was able to put it into her database at the Boston Globe. And she called me one night and she said, "You are not going to believe this." And I said, "What?" And she said, "Charles Pierce is a convicted child murderer, and he abducted a little girl just two towns away from Andy disappeared, whose body was subsequently found." And I couldn't believe it. And so, you know, immediately she wanted to get into prison to see him. And so she sent out a FedEx to him requesting that she and I go to the prison to speak with him. And I was also trying to locate him through phone calls, and it was unclear. He wasn't at the prison, but he was at an infirmary. And, you know, when we were finally able to locate him, she sent this FedEx out. But it's my position that either the prison hospital where he was staying alerted police, or the police intercepted the FedEx. I don't know which, but in any case, the police decided to go interview him before he responded to the Boston Globe and myself. And so a state police officer and a Lawrence police captain went out to the hospital where he was and interviewed him. And he said he abducted a little boy from Lawrence. And, you know, the little boy seemed to fit Andy's description. He said he abducted a little boy from Lawrence with a little girl from Connecticut named Janice Pocket, and that he buried them next to each other. And he gave some indication of where he said he buried them. So the police let us know that he gave them that information, which was very generous of them. They didn't necessarily have to let us know that. And they let us know that they were going to search this site with cadaver dogs based on his confession. And then in the midst of all of that, he died.
I wondered if it is thought that Charles Pierce used Janice Pocket to lure Andy.
You know, I wasn't there, so it was detectives that interviewed him, and that was not made clear to me. And I do know that historically, Charles Pierce confessed to things that, you know, some of the things didn't match up in his confessions, but some of the things were very compelling. So even to this day, there's a cold case unit in the Connecticut State Police that are working on some of the missing girls cases related to Janice Pocket. And they have also said that there are certainly things that don't add up that he says, but there are also very compelling things that he says that do add up. So I don't know that he said that he used one to lure the other. However, what I do know is that their disappearances were 2 years apart. I think Janice Pocket was vanished in 1974 and Andy vanished in 1976. So could he have potentially used one child to lure another? Sure. And that's certainly something that people did. And I think that nothing should be ruled out. And one of the things that I found when I started to talk about the possibility that Wayne Chapman might have been working with other pedophiles was immediately almost every law enforcement person I spoke with dismissed that idea and said, absolutely not. These guys work individually. They don't want to share their victims. They're, you know, sort of this guy in the trench coat hiding in the alleys. And I just didn't believe it because my evidence did not seem to support that. And it wasn't until even the FBI sort of dissuaded me from that opinion. And it wasn't until I reached out to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children and interviewed the then president of the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children. And he said, of course they work together. And not only do they work together, but they share images like trading cards. You know, they actually try to one-up each other on, you know, the best images that they get, or, you know, that sort of thing. It's almost like a competition in some way. So yes, very much they work together. And that was the first time that I really understood that. And then I really started to do some research around around child pornography rings and what was happening in Massachusetts at the time. And there were some very significant things happening in Massachusetts at the time. In fact, a little boy who had disappeared just a few years before Andy from Revere, Massachusetts, outside the Suffolk Sound racetrack, who very much resembles Andy, disappeared in Revere, Mass. And that was the foundation of a very large child pornography or sex ring called NAMBLA, the North American Man Boy Love Association, that was created just a few towns away from where Andy disappeared, you know, just a year or two before he disappeared. So I think that there were things that were attracting pedophiles to particular areas and where they were creating child pornography and or films to share with each other and congregating. And I think one of the places that they were congregating was Lawrence. And the question was, why?
You are probably wondering what NAMBLA is. The North American Man Boy Love Association has a website, NAMBLA.org. On their website, it says, NAMBLA's goal is to end extreme oppression of men and boys in mutually consensual relationships by building understanding and support for such relationships, educating the general public on the benevolent nature of man-boy love, cooperating with lesbian, gay, feminist, and other liberation movements, and supporting the liberation of persons of all ages from sexual prejudice and oppression. Our membership is open to everyone sympathetic to man-boy love and personal freedom. NAMBLA calls for the empowerment of youth in all areas, not just sexual. We support greater economic, political, and social opportunities for young people and denounce the rampant ageism that segregates and isolates them in fear and mistrust. We believe sexual feelings are a positive life force. We support the rights of youth as well as adults to choose partners with whom they wish to share and enjoy their bodies. Melanie and I then discussed the second suspect, Wayne Chapman.
Yeah, so Wayne Chapman, his name had come up as a suspect in Andy's disappearance, I guess, back in the 70s. But I didn't know that until I started working on the film. As a little girl, I had never been told that there was a suspect. I had just been told sort of ambiguous things, like if an adult asks you to find a lost dog, you know, you don't help them. Or if they ask you for directions, they don't need directions. Just sort of these ambiguous things, but never anything concrete or specific. So when I very naively started the film, I went back to the Lawrence Police Department and I asked for copies of Andy's police record. And I was told by an officer there that they had caught the person that had abducted Andy. And I was surprised. And I said, who? And they said, oh, you know, he was sentenced to life and he's never getting out. And he didn't really know who, but, you know, he would find out. And I went and looked in the newspapers at the local library. And I found that there was a suspect named Wayne W. Chapman. And Wayne W. Chapman had abducted two little boys from the same area the year before, August 1975. And he had taken those two boys into the woods and had raped them. And while he was raping them, the boys talk about hearing somebody else in the woods and also hearing what they thought sounded like camera clicking or a clicking noise. Ultimately, Wayne Chapman let those little boys go. And, you know, they reported the incident to their parents, who then reported it to the police. But it would be a full year before anybody was caught in those rapes. And it was 2 weeks after Andy disappeared. Wayne W. Chapman was driving in upstate New York and he had a taillight out, I think it was. And the upstate police, New York police, pulled him over for the traffic violation and noticed on his dashboard in plain sight Polaroid pictures of boys who were naked. And that gave them reasonable search to look in his van. And when they did, they found a lot of child pornography. They found movies. They found camera equipment. They found a fake police badge. They found a starter pistol. They found handcuffs, duct tape, all sorts of things that, you know, would suggest that this was somebody that was abducting children. So they sent out an APB, which at the time was like a teletype, that they would send to surrounding police stations. They knew he was from Rhode Island, so they sent a teletype to Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New Hampshire, I think several places, describing this person and what they had found. And police stations responded, and particularly police stations that had missing children responded. And so Lawrence happened to be one of them. And then Lawrence was able to get images of him and share them with the two little boys who had been raped the year before, along with other images, I understand. And those two little boys picked him out of the photos. So they knew that he was the person who had raped these two little boys the August prior. And he ultimately was convicted of those charges. But he had also raped several children in Rhode Island. He was a suspect for several missing children across New England. And then it got very political. He was brought from New York to Rhode Island, and he had about 8 or 9 rapes against him in Rhode Island that he was to be prosecuted for. But there was a little boy missing in Massachusetts whose father was well-connected and who was an attorney, I believe, or running for mayor of Brockton, Massachusetts, a little boy named David Lewison. And Chapman was a suspect in that case. And in fact, from what I understand, confessed to murdering David. That caused the governor of Massachusetts, Governor Dukakis at the time, to extradite Wayne Chapman from Providence to Massachusetts to be charged with the murder of David Lewison. However, when Wayne Chapman got to Massachusetts, the charges against for the murder of David Lewison were dropped. A grand jury apparently found that there was not sufficient evidence, so they were dropped. So now Rhode Island was pretty mad, and from what I understand, so was New York and other police entities. But they did have the rape of the two boys in Lawrence, and so Massachusetts said, we'll convict him of the rape of these two boys in Lawrence, and we'll sentence him under a civil commitment to 1 day to life. And that was sort of a way that they appeased, from what I understand, everybody. And they sent him under a civil commitment to a psychiatric unit where he was supposed to be serving from 1 day to life until he was found to be no longer sexually dangerous. And when I went to the Lawrence Police Department, they believed that he was still under that civil commitment. In fact, they were wrong. And we found that out through the Boston Globe reporter and through the research that we did together, that he was no longer under civil commitment. In fact, was about to be released from his criminal sentence. He had been released from his civil commitment in 1991, and it was 1999, and he was about to be released from the sentence, the criminal sentence for the rape of the two boys. And it was literally the film and the research around the film that drew attention to the fact that he was going to be released. And the Essex County Grand Jury, thankfully, was able to find him still sexually dangerous and have him recommitted under a civil commitment, which I think was probably one of the first times that's ever happened in the country, that they had done that. One person hadn't been released into the community and had still been under the Department of Correction. So it was a rare case. But and so now he's under a civil commitment. He was found still sexually dangerous, and he comes up every couple of years for release, and he petitions the court for release. And recently, I think it was about 6 or 8 months ago, that he just tried again. And he was found still sexually dangerous again, but he's done jury trials and he's done trials by judges as well. So, but every time, you know, we attend the trial, and it's very gruesome. You know, there are a lot of details that you learn about his life, and you realize that he's been offending against children since he was 7 years old, all the way up until the time he was incarcerated. I think he was 29 and is the suspect in the disappearance of many, many children.
There's part of the film that I found to be particularly disturbing. It has really stuck with me since I watched it, and I can't seem to get it out of my mind. Wayne Chapman would go around and videotape children, and he also made audio tapes of himself following school buses and commenting on the boys getting off the buses and what he would like to do to them.
The video that he took is the video of him watching a child playing on the rides, you know, the child sort of waving and smiling. So that was his 8mm films. The audio tape is of him watching a school bus full of children. The school buses and the footage we shot ourselves to bring to life the audio tape. But that was an audio tape that was found in his possession of him recording himself on audio following school buses full of children talking about what he wanted to do to them. And in fact, the audio tape that you hear in that session was edited, and it had to be edited for HBO, which should say a lot for folks. So we didn't edit the context of the audio tape, of course, but we did have to remove some of the comments because they were too graphic for HBO. You have no idea what he really said, too. So if you had any idea what he really said, you would realize how tortured it is. And I have to say, that is one of the things that often happens during his trial when he's coming up for a release, is they do sometimes play those audio tapes. And it's always a very painful moment to hear those again, because I remember the first time I heard them in their entirety. And, you know, once you hear these things, you can never unhear them. You can't unring a bell. You can't put the toothpaste back in the tube. So I often look at these jurors before they're about to hear these audio tapes, knowing fully what they're about to hear and knowing that it's going to change them significantly. And it's always very painful. And inevitably, they are changed. I can see by their faces that they're changed.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on. But when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished.
Melanie actually met with Wayne Chapman in prison. I wondered what it must have been like to be face to face with someone that you think could be responsible for the abduction of your friend.
I did, a long time ago. It was very early on in the beginning of the filming, and the Boston Globe reporter really wanted me to, she was finishing up the series that she was writing, and she really wanted me to go in and meet with him. And I fully intended to go in and meet with him at some point. I just realize now that that was very early on, and I know much, much, much more about him and about what I believe happened now, you know, 15 years later than I did, you know, 6 months into the making of the film or a year into the making of the film. So in retrospect, I wish I had visited him later, but I went and visited him early on, and I went into the prison and I talked with him, and it was very brief. You know, I asked him if he would tell us what happened to Andy or where Andy was, and that perhaps prison conditions could be better for him if he were to share that information, because I had been told by a therapist of his that he would not listen to appeal of compassion, that he would have to have something in it for him. And so, you know, I had hoped that if he would tell us where Andy was, that perhaps we would be able to make prison conditions, you know, somewhat more comfortable for him or something. So that was what I was proposing. And he just responded that his attorney had told him not to speak with me. And I said, you know, the difference between the attorneys and the people that he was dealing with now and the press and anybody else that had come along, you know, over the years was that he and I had been the two constants, and Andy and his family, of course, and everybody else had been the constants that had been with us since 1976. And we were both there, and that other people were going to come and go, but we were always going to be part of this. And that, you know, I was there, and that I knew that he had been to, he said he had never been to Lawrence. And I said, I know that you've been to Lawrence. I said, you were convicted of the rape of the two boys, you know, who also were my childhood friends the year before. So I know that that's not true, and that you were in Lawrence. And then he sort of said again, you know, my attorney said not to speak with you. And, you know, it was clear that we just really weren't going to be getting anywhere. And the conversation just stopped. But, you know, my impression of him My impression of him was very compelling because I had been looking at pictures of this man at 27 or 29 years old. I forget offhand what he was, but looking at pictures of him as a young man, and I hadn't accounted for the fact that 20 something years had passed when I would meet him, and that, of course, he would have aged at that point. And I was, I guess, naively expecting, you know, this man that I had been seeing in pictures. And, you know, when he came out, one thing that I was sort of surprised by was his size. He was a very big man. So that was daunting. He's tall and he was heavy, but he was also very elderly in his appearance. His hair had turned white and he sort of shook a little bit because he has a neurological sort of illness that makes him shake a little bit. So, you know, my initial instinct was sort of compassion for this person who appeared elderly. And I think that's very, very interesting because one of the things that is spoken about at his trials when he tries to be found no longer sexually dangerous is how, you know, people, he tries to say, oh, well, he's less healthy. He's more of an invalid. He can't really do, you know, certain things to take care of himself. And so he wouldn't be able to access children as easily. But on the contrary, he's much more likely to draw children to himself because he has this appearance of being vulnerable now that he might not have had as a young person. And, you know, one of the things that the prosecutor mentions a lot in his trials is that there are more than one way to rape or molest a child. And so he could clearly be capable in a number of different ways. So I guess I was surprised when I met him by what his appearance was. I hadn't accounted for the time.
I asked Melanie about the idea that Chapman and Pierce could have been working together.
I do, very much. In fact, I believe that they were working together. I don't think it was just the two of them either. I think that they were part of a pedophile ring where they were sharing children, perhaps, and or abducting them together.
In her research, she found a man who had been only 4 years old when Andy disappeared. He has said that on that day, he went into the woods with Andy to help a man look for a lost puppy.
Yes, he says, I don't know that he says specifically in the film, but certainly, you know, to me, he has said that he believes the man was Wayne Chapman, who asked them to look for a puppy. And Wayne Chapman, in fact, had been asking other children that day to look for a puppy, according to other children's testimony and other eyewitness information. And so this little boy who was four at the time said that he was with Andy and Andy offered to help look for the puppy. And he walked with Andy into the woods to look for the puppy. And they got about three quarters of the way into the, between the woods and the river, when he said Andy noticed something over in the bushes and told him to run. And so he started to run and Andy was running behind him. And he said Andy was sort of pushing him forward so that he would run faster, and that they got to the bottom of the hill just before the pool. And Andy pushed him up the hill to get him out of the wooded area. And then when he turned around, Andy wasn't there. And he looked and he said two people had grabbed Andy and had him on a rock and were hurting him. And that he ran up and nobody was at the pool for him to give the information to. And then, you know, he was sort of yelling. And then shortly afterwards, his mother showed up to pick him up and he tried to tell his mother what was happening. And either his mother didn't believe him or his mother wanted to get out of there. I don't know which. And they left. But this little boy continued to tell this story. I found documentary evidence of he had been interviewed by a police detective several years later and hypnotized. He also had sort of a breakdown in middle school where he told a teacher what had happened and then was hospitalized as a result of some of the trauma that he says he experienced. But he did not come to me. I had heard this story from other people and I was seeking him out, trying to find him. And I would try to find and I would stop and I would try to find and I would stop. And, you know, I had sort of given up finding him until one day my editor was working on the audio tapes that you hear Chapman talking about following a school bus full of children, but he also has an audio tape where he talks about taking a boy from a pool. And I had asked the editor to transcribe the audio tape so we could do what's called lower thirds on the screen where you can read what's being said so that you could understand it more clearly because Chapman has something of an accent. So she was listening to the audio tapes. And in the past, the audio tapes had been analog, but now they were digital. So when you have digital now, you can go bit by bit. Whereas in old times, you know, with audio tapes, you had to, you know, rewind, fast forward, and you might miss bits, but digital is much more precise. So my editor was digitally going through this audio tape, and I had always thought that Chapman said he took the boy from the pool with a towel. And I had never told my editor about this other little boy and his story because I hadn't found him and I just hadn't sort of given up. So I was downstairs making lunch and she was editing, and she comes downstairs and she says, you know, I'm transcribing these audio tapes and he doesn't say he took the boy from the pool with a towel. He says he took the boy from the pool with a much younger child. And I froze. And I thought, oh my God, that's this boy's story that I've been hearing all this time. And I have to find him. So I really worked hard to find him. And I ultimately did find him. And I approached him. He was working. And I approached him at his job. And I said, you know, can you please talk to me? And I convinced him to talk to me. And initially, you know, he agreed to do the interview. And initially we did it in shadow, like we did the other rape victim. And we, you know, shared it with HBO. And HBO said, you know, you already have one person in shadow. And if this person really is going to tell his story, we can't have him in shadow. He needs to come out and tell his story. And so I had to go back to him and convince him to come out of the shadow and share this story. And he was very brave and he was willing to do that. And so we had to actually interview him a second time and go through this all again with him. And he shared his story. And I believe him.
In my research, I saw that Andy had epilepsy.
So yes, Andy had a diagnosis of epilepsy, according to his mom, and he sometimes had epileptic seizures. And, you know, there's a psychic who said, you know, that that the boy was abducted and had an epileptic seizure. And interestingly, Wayne Chapman does talk about a boy that he abducted, and he says that something was wrong. When he was raping the boy, something went wrong. So perhaps that was Andy.
By now, I'm sure you're wondering what Melanie's personal theory is.
My personal theory is that Andy was targeted by a child pornography ring who was using pedophiles to lure children to be able to produce pornography. And I think what better people to use to create child pornography than pedophiles? And I believe Wayne Chapman was among those pedophiles. And I believe he abducted Andy that day from the pool. I don't believe he worked alone. I do not know whether Andy survived beyond the day that he was abducted or not. And, you know, frankly, that's hard for me to think about. But I do believe that he was abducted by a group of pedophiles, Wayne Chapman among them, perhaps Charlie Pierce among them, perhaps somebody who lived in the projects among them. And that there are more people out there who know the secrets to Andy's story, and that I continue to believe that he will come home someday. And when I say come home, I don't necessarily know that that means that he will be alive or not, but I do believe he'll come home.
In the cases that I've covered, the consensus seems to be either that the police did a great job or that they didn't do enough.
You know, I think when I first started making the film, I was really sort of indignant about how the police had handled the case, because there wasn't a lot of paper trail or evidence that was left in the file from what I could see. And then as I sort of realized contextually over time, the difference between 1976 and 1999, when I started my search, it was significant. You know, it was pre-computers in 1976. People, law enforcement, took their notes home with them. There wasn't a lot of documentation that you could follow up on. So I think, you know, it was sort of interesting initially. I think over time, I've gained a much healthier respect for law enforcement regarding Andy's case. But I also very much feel like there are many, many things that could still be done regarding Andy's case, a lot of loose ends that could still be followed up on. And, you know, I think it's very hard when a case is 40 years old for people to have the initiative to want to be able to do that, especially when they have cases that are on their desk at that moment that need immediate attention. So it's tricky. But I guess I would say I think people did the best they could when they could, but there's still much more that could be done.
This is where you can find the documentary, Have You Seen Andy?
Right now it is on HBO, on the website and on Amazon, but you have to buy the DVD. But actually Andy's 40th anniversary is this August, August 21st. I am hoping to create a director's cut of the DVD, and I'm hoping very much to get online access for the DVD for the film so that people can now access the film online. When we licensed the film with HBO in 07, believe it or not, there was not really an online venue. So you can see how much things change in just a short time. Hopefully we'll have it online soon, but right now people can buy it in DVD form through Amazon.com or HBO.com. But it's a very, very important story, and it has some really powerful educational components as well. And I think it's a timely story no matter how much time has passed. So I very much hope that we'll be able to relicense the film.
If you have any information about the disappearance of Andy Puglisi, please call the Lawrence Police Department at 978-794-5925. That brings us to the end of this episode. I would like to thank Melanie for speaking with me this week. You can visit her website, haveyouseenandy.com, for more information on the case. You can find a link to that in the show notes. I will also include a link for the DVD as well. I will be posting pictures on thevanishedpodcast.com, on Facebook and Twitter. There is a private discussion group on Facebook. Just ask to join and someone will approve you. It is only a closed group so that your comments are private. I wanted to say that the podcast community, for the most part, has been very kind to me since I started this show. People often ask me what shows I listen to. I wanted to help some newer shows and start mentioning one at the end of each episode for listeners to check out if they're looking for something new to listen to. This week, I wanted to mention a show called The Apex and the Abyss. I asked Erica to send me a little 30-second clip explaining what her show is about for you guys.
Hello, everyone. My name is Erica, and I'm the host of The Apex and the Abyss, a true crime podcast that focuses on haunting stories you may not have heard of, a few that you have, and some you should know. I started this podcast because stories about the darkness of the world has always fascinated me. But the more I've learned, the more I believe that these stories should be told, and the people involved should not be forgotten, no matter the gruesome details. I've really enjoyed making it so far, and I hope you've enjoyed listening. Stay tuned. More stories are coming.
Thanks everyone for listening, and I will catch up with you again next week. The next episode will not be about a child. I absolutely need a break from that.
I mean, I know I have a lot of people over the years that have told me, you know, oh, I could never watch that film, or I don't want to watch that film, or whatever. And believe me, nobody wants to live this story. But that doesn't mean that the story shouldn't be told. If you want to protect your child, and if you want to have information on how to do so, and also if you want to hear about a really important and compelling love story. And when I say love story, I don't mean just the relationship between me and Andy, of course. I mean very much the relationship between his family and Andy, and, you know, all of the people who continue to mourn this little boy lost 40 years ago, and all of the families of missing children who continue to experience that. And nobody thinks that it's going to be them. Nobody, you know, signs up and says, oh yeah, I'm going to have a missing child someday. Nobody does that. But pedophilia, child pornography, you know, they're billion-dollar industries. They are everywhere. And if people want to convince themselves that they're not, they're just mistaken. In fact, they are where children are, because that is what they need to survive. So being informed is very, very important. But it is a very difficult film to watch. And it's a film, I think, from what I've heard from people who have watched the film, and I continue to receive, you know, notes from people around the world that have watched the film, which is very validating. But what I continue to hear is that it is a film that stays with people, and it sort of haunts them a little bit, but haunts them in a way that I think is important, because the whole reason this film was made was that so people would remember Andy and that he would come home.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
I understand that anybody who's paid attention to the media would have to come to the conclusion that I killed my wife.
Hi, my name is Zach Stewart Pontier. I'm one of the filmmakers behind The Jinx, and I'm excited to bring you the official Jinx podcast. We'll be revisiting all 6 episodes of Part 1 and watching along with Part 2 as it airs on Max, starting April 21st.
Bye-bye.
The official Jinx podcast. Listen on Max or wherever you get your podcasts.